Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, March 27th through Saturday, the 29th, feature guest conductor and violin soloist Nikolai Schnapp-Schneider. The program includes Violin Concerto No. 1 by Max Bruch, Livre pour cordes by Pierre Boulez, and the Rhine Symphony, the Rhenish Symphony No. 3 by Robert Schumann. Here are program notes by Philip Huscher on the Max Bruch Violin Concerto No. 1, a work lasting about 25 minutes. Although he was born 5 years after Johannes Brahms, Max Bruch hit his stride much sooner. At 11, he was writing chamber music. In 1852, at the age of 14, he tossed off his first symphony. Brahms was 42 when he finished his, after nearly a quarter century of intermittent work. Bruch's first violin concerto was begun in 1864 and first performed to considerable acclaim in 1868, before a German requiem put Brahms on the map, and more than a decade before his own celebrated violin concerto. The downside of early success is the waning star. Several composers, some as great as Felix Mendelssohn, are regularly accused of failing to sustain their promise. This is a standard line in the Bruch literature, too, along with that even more worrisome one about a one-hit reputation. Neither assertion is entirely accurate or fair, although Bruch's G minor concerto has always been immensely popular, far more so than his other two, and more frequently performed than Kol Nidre for cello and orchestra, or the Scottish Fantasy for violin and orchestra. The irony of Bruch's career, particularly in light of the current admiration for art that is, above all, accessible, is that by writing music to please the audience of his day, Bruch lost the interest of succeeding generations. The G minor violin concerto, however, has withstood time, and it makes a most persuasive case for the composer. Soloists keep concertos before the public, and violinists have always loved to play this piece. Bruch studied violin for several years, and he wrote for the instrument with enormous affection and skill. When his publisher once suggested he try a work for cello and orchestra, Bruch replied, "I have more important things to do than write stupid cello concertos." Eugene d'Albert asked for a piano concerto in 1886. Bruch fired back, "Me? Write a piano concerto? That's the limit." And Bruch eventually wrote beautifully for cello with orchestra, though he never did compose a piano concerto. Bruch had difficulty writing this concerto, his first major work. There was even a public performance of a preliminary version, but Bruch was dissatisfied. The celebrated violinist Joseph Joachim offered important suggestions. He would later play the same role in the creation of Brahms' concerto, and Bruch was smart enough to take his advice. When the concerto was presented in its final form in 1868, Joachim was the soloist. Bruch also dedicated the score to him. Bruch planned to call the concerto a fantasy, which helps to explain the disposition of the three movements. The first is a prelude in title and mood, rather than the weightiest movement of the work. Even though the violinist works as hard as in any of the great virtuoso concertos, and the dialogue between the solo and orchestra is heated and extensive, the tone is anticipatory. When, without a pause, we reach the slow movement, we find the heart of the concerto, a rich, wonderfully lyrical expanse of music that shows Bruch at his best and offers melodies custom-made for the violin. The finale begins in quiet suspense, broken by the entrance of the violin with a hearty dance tune and more fireworks. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Max Bruch Violin Concerto No. 1. And now on to Livre pour cordes, Book for Strings by Pierre Boulez. The performance time, around 11 minutes. A short piece for strings, Livre pour cordes, offers us a disproportionately expansive view of Boulez's output. For one thing, it takes us to two very different points in his career, starting in the late 1940s when his radical views and bracing early works breathed new life into the music scene. Like many mathematicians, and mathematics was one of Boulez's first interests, Boulez made his mark while he was still in his early 20s. The world of music was a relatively staid and uneventful place in the 1940s and after 1945, when it lost two of its greatest pioneers, Webern and Bartók. It seemed particularly bereft of visionaries. The two aging giants of the early century, Schoenberg and Stravinsky, were still writing music, although Stravinsky was stuck in the neoclassic mode he had been perfecting for two decades, and Schoenberg was at something of a standstill, his output diminished by poor health and bad eyesight. Boulez arrived in Paris in the autumn of 1943 to study music, and the following September he began to work privately with Olivier Messiaen, who had made his name before the war as the composer of several striking and idiosyncratic works. His wartime masterpiece, Quartet for the End of Time, brought him renewed fame. Boulez was not a student for long. That is, his singular, independent musical personality quickly emerged, and with a string of compositions in the late 1940s, he rapidly staked his claim as one of the truly original musical thinkers of the time. The 12 short notations for piano he composed in 1945, later withdrawn and later still re-explored in versions for full orchestra, are among the earliest of these works. By the time of Livre pour Quatuor, Book for Quartet, composed in 1948-49, Boulez had more than fulfilled the promise he later said any teacher must expect of a student. Throw away the book I have taught you to read and add a new, wholly unexpected page. This radical new livre is the genesis of the Livre pour Cordes, the book for strings performed at these concerts. Livre pour Quatuor foreshadowed much of Boulez's development as a composer, and it also stood as a refutation of all that was passé and predictable in music at the time. The Janus face of the century at its midpoint, where the shockingly new squared shoulders against the old-fashioned, was never more apparent than in the premieres just 3 weeks apart in 1950 of two major scores, Strauss's Four Last Songs and Boulez's Second Piano Sonata. Livre, in its first version for string quartet, is a collection of six movements, although the fourth was never published, that can be played in any order. It predates the many scores of the 1950s and 60s that leave the sequence of movements to the players. It is an answer to the advances of earlier pioneering composers of quartets from Beethoven to Bartók. Taking the last works of Anton Webern and the brand new Four Rhythmic Etudes by Messiaen as more immediate points of departure, in certain movements, Boulez began to explore the idea of total serialism, where not only the pitch, but the duration, intensity, and timbre of each sound is governed by the rules of serialism. The work was introduced piecemeal over time from 1955 to 1962, among the earliest of Boulez's works to yield a series of premieres, and was then withdrawn by the composer, partly because of its extreme demands on the players. By 1968, when Boulez returned to the Livre, he was no longer a young rebel, but a distinguished leader of the avant-garde. His founding of the Domaine musical concerts in Paris in 1954 had set up an important dialogue between contemporary composers and a public interested in its own century. And the premiere in 1955 of his Le Manteau sans Maître, The Hammer with No Master, an instant classic, established him as an undisputed master in his own right. Beginning in the early 1960s, Boulez also emerged as a significant orchestral conductor. His Bayreuth debut, conducting Parsifal in 1966, was a brilliant success. Pli selon pli, fold upon fold for soprano and orchestra, a setting of texts by Mallarmé dating from 1962, was immediately recognized as a landmark in the complex landscape of post-war music. Boulez had been planning to revise Livre pour Quatuor for some time. In 1968, he set out to completely reconsider the work, now recasting it for full orchestra. The new Livre pour Cordes was never just a practical renovation, simply spreading the players' difficulties over a large ensemble, for example, but instead, a total overhaul, allowing Boulez to explore every implication of his earlier score. The original quartet was not so much expanded as exploded. At one point, there are now 34 different lines of music on the page, into a work of intricacy, depth, and surpassing textural beauty. The distance traveled is not as great as that of Notations, which blossomed from 12-measure pieces to solo piano to much bigger structures for large orchestra, but the kind of journey undertaken is of a similar transformative nature. This kind of re-examination and at the same time amplification of earlier work has become a hallmark of Boulez's output, and he was a master at considering a single musical idea from every point of view, and creating a body of exquisite, ever richer, often distantly related works in the process. Although Boulez had moved through distinct phases in his work, so-called total serialism in the 1950s, for example, or the more recent fusion of electronics with traditional instruments, essential ideas and preoccupations run through his output, linking past and present. As Boulez said in an interview with Jean-Pierre Darien, "There is no doubt that my world is now more elaborate than it was before. It is basically the same with Proust, where the beginning and end of A la recherche du temps perdu, In Search of Lost Time, are clearly by the same writer, but the whole nature and outline of the developments are different." In 1968, Boulez introduced the new Livre pour Cordes in London. It has two parts, 1A, variation, and 1B, movement. In the meantime, he withdrew the original version four-string quartet. 20 years later, Boulez returned to this long-running work in progress and revised Livre yet again, in the process making one movement of the two parts. The piece performed at these concerts is the only remnant of the original Livre in the repertory, the sole extant chapter from the Proustian book Boulez began as a young composer. And for more information about Pierre Boulez, visit cso.org/Boulez100. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Livre pour Cordes by Pierre Boulez. And now on to the Rhenish, the Rhine, Symphony No. 3 by Robert Schumann. The work lasts about 38 minutes. In his best-selling neurological case study, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Oliver Sacks tells of Dr. P, an eminent musician and professor who can no longer make sense of what he sees. He relies on Schumann's music to keep his bearings, and every action in his daily life is linked to a musical theme. Sacks, a British neurologist best known for Awakenings, which was made into a motion picture starring Robert De Niro and Robin Williams, and among other popular books, Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain, and a new bestseller, Hallucinations, published late last year, explains the real hero of Hat is surely music, the power of music to organize and integrate, to knit or re-knit a shattered world into sense. The year Robert Schumann was born, his father was attacked by a nervous affliction that troubled him the rest of his life. Schumann's own medical history is full of mysterious ailments and breakdowns, depression, hallucinations, persistent trembling, a recurring fear of sharp metal objects, and most painfully for a musician, tinnitus, a constant ringing in the ears. We now think that his mental instability first showed up when he was still in his teens. In 1844, at the age of 34, when he suffered his worst breakdown, composing was out of the question, and he couldn't even bear to listen to music, "which cuts into my nerves," he complained, "as if with knives." Certainly, in his last years, when syphilis caused his decline, music didn't have the power to re-knit his shattered world, although he spoke of wonderfully beautiful music constantly playing in his head. In February 1854, just before he was institutionalized, he was haunted by devils and visited by angels who sang to him in E-flat. He finally ran out of the house and threw himself into the Rhine. The fisherman, who saved him and took him home to his wife Clara, didn't recognize one of Düsseldorf's most distinguished citizens, the famous composer who only 4 years earlier had written his last symphony in loving tribute to the Rhine River. Even in 1850, when Schumann began this E-flat symphony, he wasn't in the best of shape. He and Clara had recently moved to Düsseldorf with some misgivings once he learned of the asylum there because he didn't like to be reminded of mental instability. At first, Schumann was unable to compose there because of the street noise. A visit to Cologne in late September 1850 greatly inspired him, and in October, he began his cello concerto, and on November 2nd, a new symphony in E-flat. The first movement was sketched in a week, and despite taking time out for another trip to Cologne, the entire work was finished by December 9th. Although Schumann sometimes is criticized for being unsympathetic to the symphonic language, the magnificent opening of this E-flat symphony argues otherwise. Here is a grand, striding theme that is both broad and powerful, obviously conceived in orchestral terms and ideal for symphonic treatment. Schumann, writing for orchestra with the same command we find in his piano music. Schumann originally called this music A Piece of Life by the Rhine. He had already captured the Rhine in song, the majestic Im Rhein, im heiligen Strome, in the Rhine, in the Holy River, from Dichterliebe, for example. But now, working with the full orchestral palette, Schumann creates one of the great German romantic musical landscapes. It's a landscape by suggestion, because this isn't a programmatic symphony, like Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. It's the expression of feelings rather than painting. If the Rhenish Symphony suggests Beethoven at all, and few musicians at the time saw the resemblance, it's the Beethoven of the Eroica Symphony, also in E-flat. In the vast unfolding of his first movement, Schumann is working on a Beethovenian scale and with material worthy of the grand dimensions. It's largely through the sheer power of his main theme that Schumann sustains such an impressive movement, because development of the classical sort was never his strength. And even here, he relies on simple sequential repetition in place of thematic sleight of hand. There's a splendid surge of energy and a new melody cleverly placed just before the end. The next two movements are modest, taking their cue not from Beethoven's Eroica, which reaffirms the grandeur of its opening with each following movement, but from the slow movement of Beethoven's Eighth, famous for daring to be so unassuming. Schumann first gives us a slow Ländler with a lovely rolling theme in the low strings as a gentle alternative to a traditional scherzo. A tiny, slow movement as delicate in dimension and scope as any of Schumann's miniatures for solo piano follows. The fourth movement is really part of the finale, a grand processional leading to a triumphant conclusion, even though they're written as two separate sections. The inspiration for this majestic and solemn music came to Robert on the Schumann's second trip to Cologne in November 1850 for the installation of the Archbishop of Cologne as cardinal, which was held in the magnificent cathedral there. Schumann immediately sets the ceremonial tone with a simple chorale in E-flat minor for three trombones. The music moves majestically, growing in strength and polyphonic complexity, and then, with the swift entrance of a striding new theme, Schumann launches his finale, an uncomplicated song of triumph in E-flat. The cathedral music returns near the end, transformed by its bright new surroundings. A passing reference to the symphony's bold opening leads to a volley of E-flat chords. Schumann conducted the first performance of the Rhenish Symphony on February 6, 1851 in Düsseldorf. Just 3 years later, he was confined to a private asylum in nearby Endenich. Clara was not allowed to see him for nearly 2.5 years. When she finally visited him on July 27, 1856, Schumann, unlike Dr. P., recognized his wife at once, but he was unable to speak intelligibly. When he died, 2 days later, Clara and the young Johannes Brahms were at his side. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Robert Schumann's Symphony No. 3, The Rhenish. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.